Well, hello everyone. A little bit different today. I have a guest, Praise of Folly, also known as Todd. How are you doing, Todd?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, hey?
Great. And thanks for coming on. You're one of the more interesting channels that I keep an eye on. And, you know, recently I've become increasingly disillusioned with, disgruntled by, sometimes just, you know, angered by the state of what is known as the online right. For a few months now, I've been calling myself sensible and center-left, right? Sensible center-left. But a part of that is a way to distinguish myself from what has become the right as we know it today. One of the reasons I've asked Todd on is because he's one of the more thoughtful people in the space, whatever the space is. We can get onto that in a second, who I think shares some of my misgivings about the direction that things have gone. I mean, I should just lay it out, Todd. In my mind, something interesting was happening, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. There was a moment where, you know, it was kind of in the aftermath of COVID and the collapse of the first Trump admin and the coming of Biden. And a lot of people were asking kind of first principles questions again in that moment. And the original, what was known as the alt-right, you know, back in 2016, had been discredited and collapsed. And a lot of that stuff had kind of played itself out as well. And there was a brief moment where some intelligent people got together and had conversations online for a while. And, you know, people started reading again and asking all sorts of interesting questions. But that didn't last that long. And it seems like almost everybody who was involved with those spaces, with a small number of exceptions, has now become a glorified cheerleading squad for the second Trump admin and for the various other forces of what I call the slop right, or kind of populist counter jihad Israel backed populism, something like this. So I have a very dismal view of the online right as it stands. To what extent do you share that picture, and if you do share it, why do you think it's happened?
Well, yeah, so I first was made aware of the online right in 2011 with the Richard Spencer podcast. And he had Colin Liddell and Nina Wiki. And while technically you could say it begins in 2007 with some of the RP stuff and some of Moldbug stuff on blogs, I was first made aware of it with the alt-right podcast. And that's sort of, there were three main groups at the time. There was the neo-reactionaries around Moldbug. There were the Manosphere types, MRAs, MGTOW, PUAs. And then there was the ethno-nationalists, right? All three of those. You might remember the flowchart A back in the day with all those little bubbles, color-coded bubbles. Yeah. And then one by one, they all kind of fell apart, right? So the first one to go was neo-reaction. Moldbug retires in 2016, I think. He's since come back. But at that point, the neo-reactionary flame started to die out, right? And then there was 2017, a bad year for the right, especially ethno-nationals, right? And then the Manosphere started to fall apart too. And so there wasn't really any... There were people left from 2017 to, say, 2021 who were trying to keep some of this around, but the big names had all gone or gone underground, and they're just kind of on life support. And then, of course, Moldbug comes back, I think 2021, 2022. So he starts bringing up that voice again. And 2021 was a bad year for the right. And so what ends up happening is all of these groups... See, what I think is the reason why they failed is because they didn't have a cohesive set of ideas. So they had like niche ideas, you know, men's interest ideas, techno bro ideas, ethno-nationalist ideas. But these are often very niche with regards to those communities, right? They could never create a unified basis. So I did a video a few years ago saying, look, the left had Marx. You could get all the leftists across the board, you know, all showing up for a rally if you had Marx. The right had nothing like that, right? They had no guy who stood above all the other guys that they could point to and say, that's our guy, let's go. that was the key thing that brought everything down between 2017 and 2021. They had no guy they could point to, whereas the left had Marx.
Yeah, interesting. And I mean, there are figures that could have been guide stars, right? My mind goes to Julius Evola, because he, his whole project, all of his books, basically, are an attempt to kind of define an authentic tradition. You may take it or leave it, but it's something like this, right? You could have, there are other people, you could have had Vico is an interesting person who's got a theory of history, or Spengler, or if you wanted to go in a Christian direction, you could make it Aquinas or something like that. But in my experience, there were usually petty sectional reasons that stop any of these things from happening, right? And the right, in my experience, always gets bogged down in the petty and sectional, right? For example, Evola, I mean, yes, he had a moment where a lot of people were reading him online. I did an Evola day on this channel. I'm still interested in some of his ideas. But one of the reasons that he could not be a goer was because of his anti-Americanism. And I mean, this is in a way part of the issue, because ultimately, and in fact, it's funny, you mentioned Richard Spencer. I spoke to him recently. And the way he put it is that he says, well, the right is like a multi-level marketing scheme where you have different sections of the audience, but ultimately the sales must funnel to the same place. In this case, the sales must funnel to Donald Trump. Okay. And obviously you can't really have this reactionary critique of Americanism and dismal view of American civilization and liberalism when ultimately what you're trying to sell at the end of it is Donald Trump, right? So for that reason, I would suggest Evola couldn't fly. He couldn't be the Marx, because if you follow his trajectory, he wants to destroy America as it stands today, right? So that can't be it, because the ultimate sell is Trump. Do you see what I mean? And yeah. In a way, this has ended up being the problem, because it strikes me that at the end of it, the intellectual energy or the dissident energy or whatever, the ideas really what were being built up for specific populist figures, and the ideas that could be absorbed, the ideas that were useful, have already been kind of absorbed and watered down in what you might call the iron law of oligarchy, right? But they can kind of take bits of it, whether it's aesthetics or the flavor of dissidence, sprinkler it in, but ultimately what you're getting at the end of it is a populist party like Farage or Trump or any of the other figures that we've seen in Europe. And the other problem then, Todd, to be frank, is that since 2016, it's become clear to me, at least, that all of these populist figures are ultimately just like part of the system, or even they're backed by one sectional part of the system. At the moment, it's evident that they're all just backed. Their real core is to get people to ultimately support Israel. That's what it seems like to me. Even though that's falling apart at the moment, Tucker Carlson, Fuentes, and so on. It strikes me that was the actual purpose of it, which then leads me to, without getting too conspiratorial, is this the reason why you got Curtis Yarvin in the New York Times or whatever? Because ultimately people are being primed, people are being prepped for this slightly new way of doing government, you can look at a figure like J.D. Vance, who's like, dressing up as his own meme and things like this, but how can I put it? Is this just a very advanced containment game, ultimately? And to me, that's what it increasingly feels like.
Right, well, I'm glad you brought that up, because so the first thing I want to say is, after Trump starts to run in 2015, I think you're absolutely right. Now, before that, so we have 2007, that come in at 2011, and then there's 2014. The reason why there wasn't a meta narrative figure on the right, like Marx was for the left. I mean, the right could have just used Hegel. I mean, after all, Marx is just poaching Hegel, right? So, but that never happened. And so, you know, I think part of that was these people weren't intellectuals, right? A lot of leftists are university professors, scholars. They're intellectuals, so they're going to be more focused on, you know, ideas and thought rather than a sort of praxis, right? Now, there were alt-right intellectuals, like, for example, Richard Spencer, right? But there was, for whatever reason, that we didn't, they didn't crystallize around a thought leader like Marx. Or Hegel could have been one. But you bring up a good thing about containment, because I did a deep dive into Moldbug 2 years ago. I did it with my friend Logos. We went through all of 2007, which was a lot of reading of UR. And he's making all these like really suspicious comments like, oh, hey, I have an uncle in the CFR, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. He does like two or three times. And I'm like, okay, what's this about? An uncle in the CFR. And then, you know, nowadays we have the thing is what a thing does kind of thing. So when I first read Moldbug, I'm like, this is just bonkers. What is this guy doing? But in hindsight, it looks an awful lot like a very well-executed PSYOP because, well, the content of what he said doesn't always line up with the truth. He's trying to do something. He's shaping a narrative. He's shaping people's minds. He talks a lot about corporate government and efficiency back in 2007. And a lot of right-wing guys bought into that because, well, they were tech bros or they were finance bros. And then you have the H-1B visa blow up in what, 2024. And they're like, oh, no, all the Indians now are going to get the jobs that we were going to get because we're, you know, in this slow march to the institutions. Kind of like a Lucy in the football moment, right? Charlie Brown's about to kick the ball and then Moldbug takes it away because it's like, no, it wasn't about you guys getting your piece of the cake. It was about containing you guys. And then, of course, now we've seen the meme around on X, you know, we've been working for the alt-right so we can fight and die for Israel, right? So yeah, I think there is, it's, I can't prove it, but I think there is, like you said, there's something in the air that indicates that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I should mention a lot of the stuff that I did both back in the day and, you know, continuously has been to try to provide things that don't have obvious sectional interests or, you know, I'm not secretly working for the interests of Peter Thiel or Vance or some like, backdoor operative or something. So, you know, when I wrote these books, what I was trying to do, you know, these ones here, Prophets of Doom, Populist Delusion, you know, there's the most recent one, Applied Elite Theory. But what they all tried to do is take a value-free frame, see things as what they are, and not to lean into the partisanship where the us versus them suddenly is like a team football game. But in my view, that attempt by me ultimately failed, and that the forces that really ended up taking over the online right are figures like Captive Dreamer. You know, like what we've seen is the captive dreamerization of the entire discourse, and happened in America. And what's frustrating is that, you know, we've watched it from Britain happen in America. Now it's just exact same thing is happening here. To me, it's like, well, as long as people like us give grist to that mill, we're going to help it. Like, I don't want to help them out. I don't want to, you know, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of these people are part of the issue because they don't have a systemic analysis of what has gone wrong. They're ultimately just feeding the machine. It's literally just, you know, especially if the frame is Democrat versus Republican or culture war, right? Or, you know, ultimately, or as you said, you did all this to help Israel. As long as the ultimate upshot is that you're helping one sectional interest, what have you actually done? So anyway, go on, Todd.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so this is actually, I think, a nice segue to, I think, one of the biggest issues with the right, online right, through all of its iterations right up till today, which it might be going too far to say that it was always a containment project, but it seems to have been harnessed for that purpose in recent years. And that's because it can't look at the situation and properly define it. So let's pick something real simple. Immigration, okay, right? Across the board, whether you're, you know, pagan, Catholic, Christian, whatever, whether you're, you know, pro-American or pro-Europe, you want this stopped. This is like the holy grail on the right. Stop the invasion. Stop immigration. Okay, well, nobody's ever sat back and asked, okay, why is this happening? Well, mega corporations want to drive down the cost of labor, right? And so they're going to start flooding the country with workers in order to drive down the cost of labor. Now, we also have on the Verge, the Whole Foods heat map, which says that, hey, look, if you have a diverse workforce, you're not going to have unions. So women and minorities are just going to get flooded in to break up unions. Okay. Now, a thing is what a thing does. So what's immigration do? Well, okay, it lowers the cost of labor. It disrupts unionization efforts. Okay. And we have a whole supply chain, if you will. These people don't come from their countries to the United States on their own. For example, in Trump's first term, a lot of that caravan was coming out of like Guatemala, moving up through Mexico. And it's like, okay, well, who's funding this? Some people say it's the Chinese. We know there's a lot of NGOs involved. Nobody can look at that machinery of logistics of picking people up out of Latin America and dropping off in the United States. And the left should have been doing that. But, you know, the anti-globalist left is gone and OMG, I love sweatshops now, right? So that's gone. And so I think this is where the old left, Marx and the socialists, have this key insight where you have to look at the hidden social relations of capital. And the fact that the right just can't do that is like the idea that immigration is the result of just some, you know, kooky professors or some, you know,
Marxism.
Yeah, yeah.
It's Herbert like, Marcuse's fault, you know.
It's Herbert Marcuse's. No, or some, you know, ethnic interests. Or the Democratic Party wants voters. It's like, look, all of those might be true to some degree, but they don't explain why this mechanism exists that picks up people from one part of the world and drops them off in another part of the world. Now, Marx describes this in his Russian preface to the Communist Manifesto. He says this is the engine of capital. And it's like, okay, that, but we can't say that. And so we come up with all of these blinds that don't actually address the immigration issue.
I should mention, Todd, Lenin mentions it in his book on imperialism as well, where he says, like, capitalism will always do this because it's always seeking, you know, to break unions and cheap labor markets. I also, as I mentioned before, came on, I've been reading Louis Althusser again recently. Now, I didn't know this book had come out. He wrote his own version of What Is to Be Done, right? It's only recently been published. But right at the start of this, there was a mind-blowing insight, which had never occurred to me before. He said, back in the 19th century, industrialists used to provide housing for the workers. You know, like Cadbury built the Bourneville Village and things like this. Like, it would be common. These were the captains of industry Carlyle talked about. So in a way, they ended up recreating the little feudal town where you had the one employer and then he had all of his workers living in rows of houses that he had built for them. And he was saying, well, like, one problem is really you don't want to be providing housing. It's an extra cost. That's a problem. But he said the real problem with building these little kind of model villages that they did for the workers is because the workers were too friendly with each other. They were living in close quarters. They could unionize. They could conspire when they weren't in work, right? It was so they built the factory, the town next to the factory, to reduce the commute time. That was the original utilitarian purpose. And what Althusser says is, like, this created an issue because it was just way too easy to become organized for labor. So he said, when Ford made the motor car available for the mass, there was a concerted effort on the part of the bourgeoisie to disperse the workforce, to make sure that all of your workers aren't in the same street, that they're from that town over there, from that town over there. Now, this had never occurred to me before, but it strikes me as very interesting. And if you have a look, I've got a book here of UK economic data. The number of strikes from it peaks in the 1890s. And then, you know, even though we associate it with the 60s and 70s, it's nothing compared to what it was in the late 19th century, down to almost nothing today. So if you see it in terms of class warfare, they've done a very good job of making it, you know, we talk about atomized individualism, but the Marxists are thinking, like, hold on, if you're all mates, you all go to the same pub, you can conspire, you can become political. ruling class has broken that up. I just found that a really interesting way of looking at the problem. But anyway, go on, Todd.
No, yeah, that's fascinating. So, and this is where Baudrillard has helped me. And by the way, I've been studying Marxist socialist literature for like 15 years now as well. The idea is that you weaponize space, that you break people up so they can't be with each other. So for example, in his work, Geography to Nowhere and Other Places, James Howard Kunstler talks about how suburbia disadvantages young children, right? They can't drive cars, so they can't leave their homes and play with their friends like grandpa did when he lived all on the same street, you know, back, you know, in the 50s, right? So it basically disadvantages children so they can't socialize with each other. He's not saying it was done on purpose, but that's an effect that happened. And I'm sure some people, like you said, with workers wanted to break them up by weaponizing space. And they weaponize space by either adding costs like cars. So you can't just walk anymore. You have to drive. And that means you have inelastic demand for gas and car repairs. Or you break up the living space, right? That's another thing. And you could tie that into with E. Michael Jones' Slaughter of the Cities, right? They all want to break up those ethnic communities. And he's coming at it from a more Catholic perspective, but the overall effect is still a labor one because the labor movement was run by the Irish for a long time in the United States, the Molly Maguires, right?
True.
And so space has been weaponized in order to break all of this up. The other thing is what a thing does, right? This anti-union attitude on the right is absurd. Who protected the borders for most of U.S. history? Unions. Mm-hmm. Unions get started in 1869 with the Knights of Labor. And right up until, you know, the subversion of the old left sometime after the 1960s. So for a good solid century, unions are policing the border. Samuel Gompers, president of the AFL, wrote that in his own day, they had to lobby government officials to stop, you know, to enforce their laws because they were getting bribed to look the other way as corporations brought in Chinese workers. And it's like, again, this has been going on for a long time. Long before there were liberal professors, long before, you know, Zionism, long before all of this. And the right just cannot point to the fact that there are rich, powerful people in this country. If you're more libertarian coded, you know, think of like the 1913 Federal Reserve Bank, creature of Jekyll Island. And if you're more left coded, you just call it the bourgeoisie, who do this on purpose. And because it helps them consolidate. There's a great book that it takes the veil off. It's called Confessions of a Monopolist by Frederick C. Howe. Published in 1906, and he talks about, okay, I'm going to tell you how the game is played. I'm an insider, and I'm just going to pull back the veil. Now, it's, you know, it's the technology's a bit dated now, but the tactics don't change, and it's a real eye-opener. When I read that, I'm like, whoa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the difficult things, though, for people like us, Todd, we're kind of, I mean, we're familiar with the Marxist literature, we're familiar with a lot of rightist literature as well, but you know, I'm saying, well, the right is basically useless. Okay, it's on a trajectory that is going to a slop-brained, nonsensical place where, you know, you build up a lot of energy and you give it to a figure like Nigel Farage, who's not going to change a thing. Let's face it. Okay, but then you start looking left, and the problem you very quickly come up with is that they're not able to tell simple truths like the ones that we've been talking about. Like, to me, the logical endpoint, the logical conclusion of a lot of this stuff is looking at the state of play today in Britain, especially, mass immigration has been a tool of class warfare against the indigenous working class. It's so obvious that it's a tool of class warfare, but the left are not able to say that. Why is that, Todd? What happened to the left to make them, you know, it seems to me that they've been contained. They've lost their edge as well, because they seem to be saluting corporations and Disney in the current year.
Well, this is a really good point, right? So 20 years ago in the United States, the anti-globalist left still kind of existed. And, you know, they were all against sweatshops, right? But now that Trump has these ICE raids, OMG, I love sweatshops now, because the kind of work that Mexican immigrants are doing in the Southwest is sweatshop labor. They're undocumented, and that's because they don't have to have the same labor regulation rights. This was all like common sense talking points on the left in 2005. In fact, Cesar Chavez, you know, the labor organizer, commented about this a lot and used some language that modern day leftists would not use today. And it's like, you know, now why? But here's the why. Okay, so the why is, and this is taking a while to figure out, if we use two terms from geopolitics, one is called frozen conflict. So the Korean Peninsula is a good example. There is no active fighting right now, but you know it could flare up at any moment, right? So that's considered a frozen conflict. And then I have to thank Caleb Maupin for this, counter gangs. The idea where you run a gang pretending to be the People's Liberation Army to then fight the other People's Liberation Army to then help keep you in charge. And the case study is the Mau Mau suppression in Kenya. So if we view the American political landscape as a frozen conflict led by counter gangs, all of this makes sense. All of these people, right and left, are being manipulated by high power individuals who are taking that energy and then redirecting it, not vertically, but horizontally, right? Divide and conquer so you don't challenge the status quo. That's the frame. And then what ended up happening is a thing is what a thing does, right? So over the years, I don't know when this started, but over the years, certain ideas were added to the left-wing palette of colors to deal with issues, you know? And so the economy becomes smaller and smaller. You know, in 1990, it's all about the economy. It's about nothing else. By 1990, it's not really about the economy that much anymore. You know, it's about all these rights issues and gender and sexuality. And now the economy is almost just completely off the table. And that's because I believe that a lot of what we might call agent counter gangs were put into the left to talk about things other than the economy. For example, how does feminism help the working class? Well, it doesn't, because it doubles the supply of labor, which cuts the value of labor in half. Now, why is feminism a part of the labor movement? Now, it doesn't make any sense that it should be. In fact, it's diametrically opposed to labor because it reduces their bargaining power. And the old left knew this. So, for example, in 1984, George Orwell says about Julia, who's a dyed-in-the-wool party member, that women are snitches and that, you know, they're going to rat you out. Well, you're not going to organize a labor movement with all these feminazis in the room, right? And so that's, I think, part of it, yeah.
Interesting, very interesting. But then you get the absurd situation where, you know, because, you know, you think of all the groups on the right and you think, well, they're just controlled, a lot of them are just controlled opposition, or even if they didn't start out as controlled opposition, through the iron law of oligarchy, they end up becoming controlled. But what you're saying is that basically the same thing has happened on the left. So essentially we end up with two fake opponents at each other. Now, looking back, it's obvious when it was, let's say, Tony Blair versus Michael Howard, right? They disagreed on everything, apart from a couple of little things. That old tour, or the old, the Mitt Romney GOP versus the Obama Democrats, it's very easy to see that they're just two flavors of the same thing. What I think is interesting now is that, and again, this is where you have to give, you know, call it capitalism, call it liberal democracy, you have to give the system credit for being as flexible enough, where there's a new Punch and Judy show where the trick is ever more elaborate, right? So now it's a populist, a militantly populist right, and this kind of abomination woke left type thing happening. Or in its new guise, you've got the left populism of Mamdani now, which is becoming a thing. But it's clear to me that Mamdani is not any sort of threat to the system in the same way that Trump is not any sort of threat to the system as it exists. And that as long as this is the discourse, they can just carry on rocking and rolling. The likes and the outrage will keep on pouring in. Netflix isn't going to go anywhere. Amazon's not going to go anywhere. Everything keeps on ticking over. I mean, is this too rosy a picture, or does the fact that the Punch and Judy show has to fray to these margins more actually put the system under more threat in your view? Interesting.
Well, yeah. So there's a lot here. I mean, there's the old, I think it's the Voltaire quote, you can tell who's in power by what you're not allowed to talk about. And so what we can't talk about is immigration. Not honestly, right? We can't talk about who's behind it. So best case scenario, right? ISIS, Trump's ICE policy works. The people who brought all these immigrants in to the country are still in power. They're still walking free, and they'll do it again because Trump will be out of office and they'll just do it again. you know, it's, you can't just win that one time, right? And then, you know, pack up and go home. No, they're going to keep doing it because they're still in power. They're still behind the curtain, right? So that's the first problem. The second thing is, on the one hand, this is what's ironic. It's Antifa that now is defending sweatshop workers by fighting ICE, which is ridiculous, right? This kind of reminds me, though, of the possibility of going too far, right? So if you go back to the late Roman Republic, Caesar and Pompey really weren't necessarily meant to be in open fighting, but it got to that point, right? It just, the patricians were behind both, funding both Pompey's expansion and Caesar's, trying to control both elements. But then they lost the plot. They lost control, and Caesar just decided to upend the whole game. Now, I'm not saying Trump Caesar. I'm not saying I know who Caesar is. But this game, that's one of the risks of the game. If you keep playing this game and you keep pushing people out to the fringes and rather than uniting around the center, you run the risk of that. And that's something that I think we should be looking for.
Mm-hmm. I mean, on this topic, there's been a very high profile falling out within the conservative movement in America recently. On the one side, you've got Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens and Nick Fuentes and so on. On the other, you've got the old guard, Ben Shapiro, Mark Levin, Laura Loomer, all of these, you know, like Lindsey Graham, etc. And at the moment, Ted Cruz, they're claiming to be battling for the soul of the Republican Party and all of that. Is all of that genuinely happening, Todd, or is it another? Is it, as Richard Spencer has alluded to, another part of the multi marketing strategy? Like, and even if it is kayfabe, does it risk actually becoming like a proper war that could implode the Republicans or something like this?
Well, think about it this way: since I've already framed this in terms of geopolitics and like ops, you know, in like a lot of like Cold War movies and even in real life, you'll have agents that sort of go rogue and have to be taken care of, right? They were at one point controlled by some intelligence agency, but then they just sort of start going their own way. And that's always a risk. That's one of the costs that the game entails, right? And so I think the question then becomes, are we reaching a point where some of these agents are, you know, getting a little bit beyond what they were supposed to do? As can happen, right? And I think one reason why we should pay some attention to this, I'm not willing to say that it's like totally legitimate, but when the Zionists made the complete pivot, right, after October 7th, 2023, you know, there was this new fissure on the right now, because the one of the things that right-wing Jewish commentators in the 90s and 2000s would say is, why are you on the left? The Palestinian question is a left-wing issue. You know, why are you this, that, and the other thing? And they're like, well, you know, reasons. But after 2023, October 7th, they all move right. Trump gets a green light to do all sorts of heavy-handed stuff with regards to security inside the country. I would argue because he played ball on foreign policy, right?
I agree. Yeah.
20 years ago,
he wanted Trump. I said that all the way through the action. Yeah, go on.
20 years ago, the Zionist class would not have done this. There's no, they wouldn't have done it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think whether this is a correct apprehension of the situation, I believe they think it's existential, because a lot of the alliance on the left is still rooted in the Palestinian argument, and now they view these people as threats to them, right? And so that's why they're allowing Trump to deport all these people with ICE. They're like, well, I don't know. That's just future anti-Semitic shock troops from the point of view of the Zionists, right? So at the very least, I think what it represents is a paradigm shift in their thinking. Now, will that amount to a more you know, fluid environment in the future? I'm not sure.
Interesting. So, I've had the thought more than once, and I've said so, you know, on this channel before, that I don't want to sound like a Q person here, right? Because, you know, their whole argument was that there are black hats and white hats and all of this sort of stuff. But it has occurred to me more than once is that the element that may have gone rogue, Todd, as you put it, is not actually Tucker, but is actually the Zionist part of it. That there's an element of the American system that realizes that runaway train needs to be kind of, they need to put the brakes on it, and they need to kind of, I don't know, like they realize the damage it's doing. And so in order to, because think about it, I mean, there's two futures here. there's a future where Israel is reined in, which I think could put, you know, plus decades onto the American empire. Or there's a future where they just crack down on all their opponents. Nobody's allowed to speak out. They consolidate control and they just become more and more insane. It strikes me that all of the voices like Tucker are actually just trying to help steer the American ship of state back on course. They're actually trying to help everybody by pulling this maneuver. And so sensible is it that I'm one of those people who's like, I wouldn't be surprised if we find out down the line that the one who's actually working for Central Power is Tucker himself. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And so, for example, this line of thinking, right, at least in the modern political landscape, goes back to Pat Buchanan. He's like, well, hey, look, American foreign policy should be for American interests, not the interests of a foreign state like Israel. And that got him into a lot of trouble, but he was an old timer. He, you know, did his dues. So he stayed in the political landscape until he retired. And the issue is, though, I think more and more people are realizing that he was onto something. Like, why is it that the United States and all of its resources are being used to prop up the foreign policy of another country? And in this case, Israel, right? And that would lend credence to your idea that it's the Zionists that are going rogue. Because we all know that if the Greater Israel Plan, they would not be pushing this if they did not believe that U.S. would back them up. They wouldn't be doing this if they didn't believe that the U.S. would be backing them up.
So to come back to the central, you know, the thing where I'm going to, I don't know what the video is going to be called yet, but we're going to, it's sensibly, we're saying, like, I think the online right was a failed project. I think that the online right has become something quite pathetic. But just playing devil's advocate a second, you know, this whole conversation that we're having, this fact that, you know, Tucker's had to move to this position that he's had, he's had to have Fuentes on and so on. There's an argument that could be made that, you know, the online right made this possible. I'm going to put that out there as an idea. How would you respond to that basic premise that, you know, or is this just the system doing what it does? Yeah, go on.
Well, that's an interesting question. Because on the one hand, we could step back and go real mud in and say, what exactly was the online right in the first place? I think part of the reason why it's so difficult to analyze its success or failure is the failure to define what it is or was. Because it was a lot of different people coming together in a lot of different ways. In fact, I remember I did a video a couple of years ago that you watched, AA, where I said it's kind of like a free speech zone where white guys can or guys can get together and talk about these things without being silenced that they would be in other parts of the country, right? So maybe we could view the alt-right as sort of like the cafes before the French Revolution. All of that stuff was still being cracked on by the French police, by the French security forces, but it got enough ideas out that the future generations could then use that to upend the Bourbon dynasty, right? So it could be that. That would be the most optimistic reading, I think.
I don't know if we can leave it. I mean, there are other analyses available. Okay. Let's pretend that the online right did not exist at all. Would we still kind of be in this place? Because I've got a funny feeling, Todd, that the thing that I don't want to say radicalized, but the thing that woke people up to what we're talking about here and why Tucker is there and, you know, why we're having this discourse at all actually has nothing to do with online discourse. It's not because they read Curtis Yarvin or watched me, right? It's just because of the actions of Israel. It's like they were just like, we've just watched a country bomb women and children for 2 months, 2 years straight, and have the entire political class say, yeah, don't ask any questions about that. That's fine. I mean, really, that is the thing that has got people left and right up in arms, not anything that I don't really think that people have quote unquote woken up because they, you know, they watch 40 hours of podcasts.
Well, yeah. And to that point also, when you look at how these events, like, so COVID was an event that woke people up, these external causes. One of the things that the right, and I was a critic of this at the time, when Trump got elected the first time, a lot of the online right said, oh, we got him in through memes. I'm like, okay, you know, it probably helped some, but let's be serious. That's not what got Trump in the White House, right? It was a self-congratulatory backpatting. And that is a big problem on the right. They'll look at some goal that was achieved that they were also aligned with, and then say, well, we did it. I was like, well, no, this is where you have that skill gap in right-wing thinking. The hidden social relations of politics and economics, they weren't seeing. They couldn't see. And so all the backdoor dealings that actually made this possible, they just could not or would not see. And then there are external triggers, right? So COVID was an external trigger. The Russian invasion of Ukraine, I guess, was one. Israel's war with Gaza was one. And they all start flipping switches. And the contradictions that were building up in people, you have to pick. You have to pick one or the other. Which is it? And then it's that process of fission where you keep flipping these switches to force people to choose that causes these disruptions.
Mm-hmm. No, I think a lot of it is driven by events more than streams or what people are saying. And one of the ways to see that is just to go back and see what people were saying at the time. Like, you can actually go back 5 years to see what people were saying at the time. And many of the people who now claim credit for waking people up and so on would not even saying that sort of stuff 5 years ago. You know what I mean? They have actually been swept along by a lot of these currents as well. All right. Well, just before we get going, Todd, we could easily talk for hours. What are some, you've talked a lot about economics, a lot about the kind of structural view that the Marxists have of, what you call the bourgeoisie and the working class. Are there any other areas that are deficient on the right in general?
Yeah. Well, actually, this is a really great segue here, right? Because I know a lot of people on the right like Carlyle. And then Carlyle is a great, great read, great ideas. There's a key concept that Carlyle has that both Marx and Engels make attribution to in their own writings, that of the cash nexus. The idea that for every social relation, it's been replaced by cash exchange. So he comes up with the idea. He writes about it during the Chartist controversy in the 1840s. And then Marx and Engels pick up on it too. And why is this important? Well, that's the ratchet. The ratchet is the cash nexus, because if you correlate that Baudrillard's levels of simulation, you go from reality to simulation level one to simulacra through this ratchet effect of the cash nexus, where you see these things not as what they are, but as they are mediated by cash exchange. So as a concrete example, churches, right, ought to be place, or any religious building, right, ought to be a place where you come closer to God and to your fellow religionists. And the relationship in the Christian context is agape, the love of others that the Christian has for the brethren. But today, because of the cash nexus, that's been replaced with money. But we can't talk about that. In fact, you better not talk about that. But, so it hides this reality. The real reality is that money is what's driving these relations, when in fact it should be agape, right? And so what they're saying now is, all right, guys, we can't talk about this. It's really money. So if all your social relations become money relations, they're now it's market. It's no longer a social body anymore. And that's huge. The right and it's funny, the cash nexus comes out of Carlyle, who's a reactionary. So he's like a very far right guy. And then Marx and Engels pick up on it and then work with it. And I think that's interesting. And I think that that's an area where, if you want to get a little spicy, the Red Brown Alliance could get started, Carlyle.
Yeah, interesting stuff, Todd. Interesting stuff. To come back, I guess another issue, right, and one more issue, is that so much of online right discourse is, I know this is an over, people use this word a lot, but there is also a lot that's just the grift, isn't it? There's a lot of people, are literally just in it to sell merch, or they're not actually in it to do anything more than shift product at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And if you were to compare that to historic Marxist movements or Islamist movements that actually wanted to win, their leaders say and do and act very differently than right-wing leaders in Europe and America, because they were operating outside of the cash nexus, one from a Marxist point of view, one from an Islamist point of view. And they're like, we don't do things in order to make money. We do things to win. Okay, we're here to win and overthrow the system. Whereas on the right, these faux dissidents are like, well, no, we actually want to just be comfortable bourgeois, you know, petite bourgeoisie.
So there is, I mean, within that framework, there is no actual possibility of revolutionary action, is there?
Yes, there is no possibility.
It ends up being kind of like a, I mean, again, to evoke Q, sit back and get your popcorn, sit back and enjoy the show. That's because ultimately that's what it turns into.
Right. The only way to have legitimate revolutionary action is to understand the landscape in which we are living and acting, and then you yourself act in a superposition outside of it. Now, that's going to be mental. That's what Lenin did. That's what the Taliban did. But eventually it then becomes material.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, well, Todd, where can people find you? And if you people have never checked you out before, what's like one or two videos or streams that they could get acquainted with your work?
Yeah, well, you can find me on the Praise of Folly podcast. Just type that into YouTube and it'll show up. You can find me on X at POF Podcast. Now, I have two regular shows. I have on Thursday with Florian, what I call political commentary, where we just comment on the political U.S. politics, both domestic and international. And that's a regular Thursday show. You can see that every Thursday at 6. And then every other Saturday, so that would be this coming Saturday at 2, I have a roundtable discussion with Keith, Florian, and Alec, where we talk about all sorts of different things. And you mentioned before the stream, and I think this is actually really important, my trans video, where I analyze the trans movement from a more classic labor Marxist critique rather than the right critique. I'm not saying the right critique has no value. It's just incomplete.
Yeah, and that was I watched that video and then immediately started bugging people on Twitter by quoting bits of it by, you know, trans is a purely capitalist phenomenon. As an example, you know, which is not yeah. to say that there's never been a trans person in a communist country, but it the cultural phenomena of it is it actually comes out of, I guess, the you know, the liberation theology of capitalism.
Well, you know,
it's literally setting the individual free from all constraints. Capitalist idea.
Well, yeah. So like, well, the entire LGBTQ plus movement would not exist in a communist country. So Yakov Smirnov had a popular joke in the 80s, Soviet dissident. He said that Soviet homosexuals go get a 25-year prison sentence to be in prison with other men. So, you know, that's the joke, because there's nothing about that's Marx called that bourgeois decadence. That's not socialist. That's not communist.
Yeah, no, when I was reading, you know, I've been studying Stalin era stuff recently, and I had to, I can't remember if it was in Molotov or in Stalin himself, but like Stalin had this view that homosexuality was latent fascism, yes. i.e. the reason he outlawed it is because it's correlated with fascism, which not only is funny, but it's also like weirdly true, Todd.
We've all seen it, haven't we? We've all seen it.
I mean, it's just like, I mean, I think there's probably another explanation, which is that if you don't have a family, if you don't have a bourgeois family, right, as a lot of gay guys don't, you have more time to devote to politics, or politics becomes, you know, a surrogate for domestic life or something like that. So I think that you see an over-indexing of gay guys in every political movement, including far-right ones. Yeah. Like the Conservative Party in this country is basically a gay club.
Well, that was the whole Rockefeller Republican angle, right? Going back to the 70s, the Rockefeller Republicans. But then also the Democrats catch it on this too in the 90s and early 2000s. That those were their guys, right? Their flagship avant-garde.
Yeah. So there's a whole, like, you know, if you think of the organized minority, right? Well, if you're meeting in exclusive male-only spaces, you can also conspire, to go back to something we're talking about.
You can.
Earlier. So that whole idea of like pink mafia being a real thing is actually, there's a truth to it.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, because you're not grilling with your family or whatever. But anyway, check out Todd. He has that trans video is very interesting. He's got a number of endless hours of great content. Check him out. You know, I'm not trying to grift, but pick up a course at the academic agency. If you do that, you will develop some of the critical thinking skills. But I still have to live in the bourgeois world, Todd. This is the problem. I still have to make money. So is this the bind? I reproduce the capitalist within myself.
I know. That's a problem, isn't it?
That's how they get you. But anyway, yeah, pick up a course, my new book, Applied Elite Theory, and catch you next time. Thanks a lot, Todd.
Thank you.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.